to the whole of that range before the community split. Perhaps they were merely trying to reclaim territory that once they had lost. We don't know what other factors were involved. There have been movements of people, human people, outside the park, and it seems that a large community of chimps has moved in to the south of the southern group. This may have caused some feeling of pressure, of overcrowding. We simply don't know. And until we can witness something of the sort again, we shall not know. It's little use really speculating too intensively on an incident as a result of just one occurrence like that. So we'll have to wait another 10, 20 years to see whether anything similar may happen again. I want to diverge even more at this point, just for a moment. I want us to leave the chimpanzees at Gombe and think for a little while about some of the work that's been done in this country, a little bit in Europe, but mostly in the United States, on teaching captive chimpanzees language. The first attempts, of course, were made to teach chimpanzees to speak, and these attempts were abysmal failures. The most that any chimp learned to say were four words, and if you hear those words on a tape, they are very feeble attempts indeed, with a stretch of the imagination, and providing you know what the word is supposed to be, you can vaguely work out that Vicky managed to say cup, mama, and papa. But that was all, in spite of years of very, very intensive training. Then the gardeners began teaching a young chimpanzee sign language. And interestingly, this was first suggested way back in the 1930s by Professor Yerkes, who brought the first chimpanzees over for scientific study to the United States. At any rate, Washoe was taught the sign language of the American deaf, Aslan as it is called. And since then, many other chimpanzees have been taught sign language. In addition, Professor Premack in California began to teach a chimpanzee to use plastic symbols. Each symbol represented a word. And she was taught the meaning of these words, not only nouns, but also verbs and propositions, question marks, full stops, and so on. And she would place these words in response to questions on a magnetized board, and each of these plastic symbols had a magnetized back. The third experiment in teaching language is the one going on at Yerkes today with a chimpanzee called Lana, who has an extraordinarily sophisticated piece of equipment. She lives in a little 7x7 plexiglass cube. There is a large computer outside this cube, and Lana has access to a whole series of plastic buttons, each one of which has a symbol indicating a word. When she presses one of these buttons, the symbol not only lights up on the keyboard, which she presses, but also up on the wall. And she can see the progress of her sentence as she taps out the different buttons. And I just want to spend a moment giving you a few examples of the kind of communications that it has been possible to work out with the chimpanzees in these three different systems. Because, at least for me, it helps to understand a little better the communication system of the chimpanzees at Gombe. It gives us a better idea of what the chimpanzee intellect is capable of. And it also poses some puzzling questions as to why chimpanzees in the wild don't communicate in a more sophisticated way than in fact they do. This is why I want to deal with the sign language before coming back to the communication patterns of the chimps at Gombe. If we take first Sarah, the chimpanzee who learnt first to use plastic symbols, she learnt to say things like, "Please, Mary," Mary being the trainer, "please, Mary, give Sarah an apple." She would be asked questions like, "If Mary puts an apple in a blue bucket, then Sarah will get a candy." things like this, quite sophisticated, long sentences, and Sarah would write answers up on her board with her symbols. And perhaps one of the most fascinating things to emerge from this was that it showed that chimpanzees do have the ability to form an abstract concept, which people say, or linguists say, is one of the prerequisites for human language. One of them is memory, of course. One is a concept of an abstract symbol, and another is some form of grammar. Sarah was taught grammar quite carefully. She had to put her plastic symbols in a grammatical order, or she got no reward, and she got rather good at this. But, for instance, the symbol that she was taught for an apple is a little blue triangle of plastic. Now, Sarah was shown an apple, and she was asked with these little plastic signs, the experimenter writes the questions up on the board, is this red or blue? And Sarah answered, this is red. Then she was asked, is this round or square? And Sarah answers, this is round, and so on, with several more questions. Then another day, when there's no apple in sight, not the day following or even the day after that, but perhaps the next week, the little blue plastic symbol is produced. And Sarah is asked, is this round or square? And she writes back, this is round. Is it red or blue? And she writes back, it is red, which seems to suggest that she has an actual concept in her mind of an apple, and it's represented to her by this little plastic square. There are a lot of people who will argue and say it's just a result of conditioning, but let me go on to the other experiments, because it's when we put everything together that we begin to find something rather extraordinary seems to be taking place. Go on to Lana, who has her little computer machine and lives in her plexiglass tube. Lana will type out on her keyboard, please machine, give Lana milk. And she has to put a period at the end. She must start with please, and this helps the computer to process whether or not she's made a grammatical utterance. And if she's correct, there's a little tone that goes off, and a click, and the machine delivers whatever Sarah's asked for. She can ask for quite a variety of things, films, windows open, or for the experimenter to come in and tickle her. She'll rather pathetically sometimes type out in the middle of the night when nobody's there, please machine, come and tickle Lana. And it's a correct sentence, but of course she gets no reward. One of the things she learned to do by the use of this machine, which they said was extremely difficult to get across to her, was to ask what was the name of something. She had learned box is the name of this being a little symbol that she'd learned, or Mary is the name of this person. But one day, she actually managed, when there was a reward hidden in a tin, and she didn't know the name for tin, to say, what is the name of this? And she was told the name of this is tin, all on her buttons, of course, and she was given the reward from the tin. And after that, and this is the interesting thing, when there was something whose name or which name she did not know, she would ask what the name was. And she now has a vocabulary of about 400 different symbols or words. Then we come on to the sign language, which I've left till the end, because in many ways it appeals to me most. It's very spontaneous. Chimps are now being brought up in homes with human deaf people who've never spoken anything but Aslan. And it's a very kind of spontaneous interchange of ideas, of things that you can get with these signing chimpanzees. And one of the things I picked out to discuss this evening, because it seems to fit in so well with what we're talking about this evening, was an experiment where one of these signing chimps was played a tape of chimpanzee calls made at Gombe. And this was a tape made by Peter Mahler from the Rockefeller University, sent to Roger Fouts, who was working with the chimps, And Roger Fouts knew what the calls were that he was playing, but that was all he knew. So he started playing the tape to this little chimp. I forget which it was, but let's say it was Washoe. And the first tape that he played, there were two of them. He played Flo giving pant hoots, the old female Flo giving pant hoots, and Mike giving pant hoots. And the series of experiments he was working on required the chimp to sign same or different. So, okay, Flo pant hooting and Mike pant hooting. And the chimp signed back same, different. So he thought, well, this doesn't really make any sense. Anyhow, he went on, he played the next tape, which was Fifi pant grunting and Figgin screaming, and the chimp signed different. Then he played Figgin screaming and Figgin barking, and the chimp signed back different, same. Then he played an alarm call, and the little chimp ran up a tree. Well, I think the fascinating thing about that experiment is that at the time, Roger had no idea that different chimps were involved. So he thought that the chimp was just signing nonsense. But something made him go and check, and then he found that every time the chimp distinguished between not only the individual chimpanzee signing, but, you know, when they signed different calls. So they understood both, when the calls were the same, but made by different chimps, when the calls were different, but made by the same chimps. In other words, he was told more than he asked. And that is the kind of fascinating results that we find if we read through the literature on the signing chimps. The last thing I want to say on this, because this isn't really what I'm here to talk about, only I do think it's so fascinating, is that these experiments, or whatever we like to call them, give us a fascinating sidelight on the way the chimpanzee conceptualizes his world. Little things we might never think of if it wasn't for the new ability to actually communicate with a chimp on his own level. Washoe, the first chimp to learn sign language, for instance, was taught the sign, whatever it may be, something like this, for flower. She was shown a rose and told, this is a flower. And then she was shown a daffodil, this is a flower. And a, sorry, hyacinth, this is a flower. And they thought, fine, she knows it. She was shown all these different flowers and she always signed flower. And then one day she went into the kitchen where there were beautiful aromas of cooking and she got very excited and began signing flower, flower, flower. So they suddenly realized that where they'd thought she knew flower, what she picked out as the identifying concept in all these different flowers was the fact that they all had a scent. And that's a very fascinating insight into the way the chimpanzee mind works. And the only other one I want to mention is when all manner of different chimps were presented with a series of food objects and asked what they thought about them. To take one of the chimps, Lucy, she had certain general names like food and fruit and drink, and then she had specific names like banana and orange. She didn't have too many, and she generally used food or fruit. She was shown a whole host of different foods, and she usually did say food or fruit, or if it was an apple or a banana, she said it was an apple or a banana. Then she was shown some celery and asked, signed, what is this? And she signed back pipe food. She was shown a Brazil nut and she couldn't open it. And she signed back, this is a rock berry. Then she was shown a watermelon. She called this a candy drink. And Lana, the more sophisticated chimp with more sophisticated grammar, was shown a cucumber, and she said, this is a banana which is green. Now, at that point, I want to come back to the chimpanzees at Gombe and talk a little bit more about the calls and the gestures and postures which make up their communication repertoire. Their communication signals can be tactile, touch, They can, of course, be auditory when they hear the different calls. They can be olfactory. They do make use of scent cues, such as on the patrols when they pick up and sniff leaves. And also when a female is in estrus, a male may inspect her genital area and sniff his finger. And, of course, they can be visual, as with all the different facial expressions and postures. And a communication signal can be a very sort of general, non-directed signal. This is the kind of communication I'm including in this discussion. For instance, a male chimp tops a rise, he's entering a new valley, he gives his individualistic pant hoot. He's not particularly directing that towards any other chimp. It really signals, here I am, is anybody listening? And then he's likely to climb a tree and listen quite intently for a response. But on the other hand, a male may spy an estrus female, and he may vigorously shake a branch at her, or stamp his foot, or swagger. And this is clearly directed, and it's quite clearly directed towards changing the behavior of the female. He wants her to come to him to present sexually so that he can mate her. So there are these two quite different kinds of communication, both of which I'm including under the general heading of communication. The female chimpanzee has a sexual swelling, comes round once a month, providing she's fertile and not lactating or pregnant. And when she develops her sexual swelling, it's a kind of general advertisement. It advertises her wares to any potential male who's interested. But she may equally approach a certain male and present herself to him sexually, solicit copulation, in which case it becomes a directed kind of a communication signal. So with that little introduction, can we now have the slides? Unfortunately, I don't have pictures showing all the different calls, but anyhow, you saw some of them in the film. This is one of the easiest of all the chimp calls to identify. It's the pant hoot. It's used very much as a distance communication signal, keeping contact between scattered groups. If a mother loses one of her family, she's apt to pant hoot, and the lost individual pant hoot in return. This group is pant-hooting in response to calls given by a distant group. And as we've said before, each pant-hoot is very individualistic, and even we, with our human ears, find little difficulty in knowing which individual has made a pant-hoot. Other calls which they make are less easy to identify according to individuals. Here is a scream. You heard screaming in the film. I don't think I need to demonstrate a scream. This young adult male is frightened. This is one of our early banana boxes. We don't have strange-looking things like this at Gombe anymore. And he's screaming because he sees an older male, a higher-ranking male approaching, and he's fearful. So not only is he screaming, but he's showing a grin, a full open grin, we call it, at the same time. This is the same sort of thing, and I put this in, it doesn't show terribly clearly, but when you're out in the dark forest and chimpanzees grin widely like this, they're not always screaming, and it really does act as a very dramatic signal. In the darkness of the trees, this bright pink gum and the white teeth are seen very, very clearly, and sometimes when chimpanzees are suddenly frightened, they will look at one another and grin quite silently, but as I say, the signal value is very dramatic and very easy to see. You can see the two males here are both grinning, and the one behind has reached out to touch the other. This is the same sort of thing, slightly lower intensity grin. It's David Greybeard, as a matter of fact. His teeth aren't so good anymore. And here is a very common submissive pattern. These slides, incidentally, aren't in the most perfect order. I haven't gone perfectly from one sequence of behavior to another, and partly on purpose, because the calls and the postures, the communication signals are not only to be found in one particular behavioral context. They really do span quite a wide range of behavioral contexts. So we'll just go through them as they come, but as you see, they're in some kind of an order. The female Ollie, over here, if I can get this thing to work, is giving the pant grunt as she approaches an adult male. She's showing submissive crouching, and she's approaching him in greeting. She's been separated from him. They are now being reunited. Here, I'm not sure if you can see it very well, but a juvenile female, Fifi, has approached her mother, and she wants to take over her mother's termite hole. She's been unsuccessful in finding one herself. So she's, again, showing rather submissive posture with her arm bent up and a slight whimper on her face. And she'll be sounding rather like that. This is the play face. It's two adult females playing, which isn't very common, which is why I showed this picture. But Gigi is our largest female. She's sterile and has been cycling since 1965 with having no babies. She's extremely large, she has a lot of masculine, aggressive type behavior, and she's playing with another large young female who's not yet had her first infant. They're showing the hand wrestling behavior that very often precedes adult play, and Gigi has a well-developed play face. If you think of yourself smiling, you'll see the difference. We show our upper teeth first, and the chimps, when they're smiling, show their lower teeth. And then in both our species, as our grins become more pronounced, we show upper and lower teeth. Another. Another play face, adolescent male playing with a juvenile male. Chimpanzees. When they're performing those charging displays that you saw so well in the film, show a compressed lips face, as we call it, and sometimes strikes one that chimp expressions are quite similar to human expressions sometimes. Sexual swelling. So I mentioned earlier the female chimpanzee can advertise her wares to any interested male. And here's an adult male down in the foreground, and he's showing the beginning of a courtship sequence. You can see the erect penis down here, the thighs spread apart, and he's looking up. Maybe the slide focuses a bit more, I'm not sure. He's looking up at one of the females in the tree. It's the one right up at the top who has a sexual swelling, and eventually she will come down in response to that. It's quite interesting, sometimes there will be two females with sexual swellings, and it's usually quite clear to the observer which female the male is courting, but sometimes the second female, maybe she's just hoping to try her luck, she will come and solicit instead, and usually the male will then ignore her. And there are quite a few times when you see communication going a little wrong in the sexual context. This is the arm stretch, typical courtship gesture, and a female running up in response. That's Leaky again. And here's the outcome. A typical copulation, and you see the full grin here, the female. She's actually not laughing or anything, she's giving what we call a squeal. It's very typical of copulation and can be identified from quite a distance. So very often if a male hears that sound, he will go racing along to see what's happening. And the behavior of the infant here, it's very typical, whether it's his mother or not, he is likely to run up and interfere in a copulation. We don't yet understand this, but interestingly, he, or sometimes she, will usually direct their attention to the face of the male who's mating the female. This adolescent female here, Pom, is also sexually receptive, and whenever there's any other female in estrus around, Pom is always very close by, but the males aren't particularly interested in her yet. Now here's an adult male courting a young female, Gilka in fact. You can see her swollen nose. She has a fungus infection there. The male with his erection, and he's, you can't see very well up there, but he's shaking a piece of frond in courtship. And Gilka doesn't respond properly. She's still not presenting. She's screaming and clutching the tree. And he's picked up a whole frond here. He's waving it around at her. You can see hair erection on his part. And she still doesn't present, so he grabs her and gives her a hit, not very hard. His hair is even more erect than before. She's still screaming. And finally, she does present for him. And here's a young male up here about to run over and interfere. This is something we saw in the film, adult male trying to persuade a female to accompany him on a consortship. He's shaking a branch. Sometimes if females refuse to follow in this situation, the male will actually attack her. And this happens fairly frequently, and eventually the females learn to follow individual males. This is going back to the young female Pom, who shows rather ambivalent behavior towards males. She's the young female who spends a good deal of time sitting close to males. She'll watch them. She seems to be anthropomorphic. She seems quite eager to be mated by the males, but as I said, they're not very interested in her. And here she's approaching one of the adult males. He turns his head away, and now she's tapping his nose. He still turns his head away. You see a slight pout on her face. And this was the end of the interaction. After that, she moved away. It's quite common behavior on her part. But again, it's one of these things that is characteristic of Pom. You don't see other females going up to males and dabbing their faces like this. Social grooming. Grooming does occupy a terrific amount of time in chimpanzee society. Adult males groom a great deal. Females and their youngsters groom. And there are a number of gestures and postures associated with grooming. This is typical for the youngster, the infant, or the juvenile, sometimes even the adolescent, to raise one arm in this posture that you see here. And this is an invitation to be groomed. Old Flo is paying no attention to Flint here. Here, two adolescent males. To start off with, Goblin over here is grooming Mustard, who's slightly younger. And it's rather rare for adolescent males to groom one another at all. They're 12 and 13 here. And after a bit, Goblin stops grooming. He scratches himself, which is another indication that he would like to be groomed in response. And Mustard also scratches himself, and this was a deadlock and the grooming session ended. Now we come on to the repertoire of threat and aggressive patterns, and here's a very typical swaggering, threatening posture with a female in the foreground showing a submissive crouch. Same sort of thing, this time a female is showing the bipedal stamping, hair erect, as she threatens the female crouching in the foreground. Both these pictures are competition for bananas. Here, young Flint, aged 5, is about to throw a rock at Gilka, juvenile Gilka, who's bending away submissively here. It's the beginning of the long struggle that the male starts when he's around 4 or 5 years of age to dominate the females in his community. Here, this is again in the feeding area. The object you see there is a block of salt, and an adolescent male is waving a frond, threatening a baboon. Two females. The female in the foreground is the higher ranking of the two. She's more upright, and Gilka here is bending away, about to give way. Adolescent male, nearly mature, threatening a female. When two chimpanzees are frightened, very often one will reach up and touch a companion. It doesn't matter whether the companion is higher ranking or lower ranking or the same rank as himself. A child will reach out and touch its mother if the mother is there, but an older individual will touch another individual.